Goddard Reel 14.
Well, you can imagine that we were relieved on board to see those craggy cliffs of Round St. Abb's Head disappear, and to have and to feel sure that we had land underneath us, although we couldn't see it because it was pitch dark and there were no lights in the countryside. But I knew that there had been in that region an airfield under construction that day, and I'd seen a great numbers of men working manually. They were, in fact, a battalion of prisoners of war, Germans, making it under the supervision of soldiers. So I thought that there we had a ready-made landing party, and if I could find that area, and I thought I had, we could come down and flash that we wanted assistance, and everybody would come to our aid. There were, in fact, twinkling lights in the village or township of Haddington, where this took place, but I may be wrong about that. We were over the right place, and we were over the airfield, but nobody came to our rescue. All that happened is we flashed our need for help. We used SOS, and we used various appeals to the army for landing and so forth, while our engines were driving us ahead, and in fact keeping us just over the one place on the ground. All that happened was that the few twinkling lights that there were visible in the village were extinguished, and the place became darker than ever. And when it became quite clear that we were not going to be rescued and nobody was coming to our help, we decided to make a landing, because we hadn't got enough fuel at that speed to get back to East Fortune. We'd nearly finished our fuel supply. And so we dropped our trail rope, we dropped the grapnel down it, hopefully that this would catch in something, and we then, with the engine still running, lowered ourselves down towards the ground, although we couldn't see it, when all of a sudden there was an upheaval in the car, and in fact we had landed in the middle of the only trees left in the middle of this airfield, two big oak trees standing close together which hadn't yet been felled. These penetrated the car, they penetrated the envelope, we pulled the ripcord, we were enveloped, and we stopped the engines. Mercifully nothing caught fire, but we were suddenly in a very dark tent with a large smell of gas, and smothered by our own envelope, with the car at about an angle of 45 degrees and everybody in a bit of a mess. We clambered out. The front end of the car did in fact hit the ground. We were able to get out there onto dry land and remove ourselves from this. And wrapping ourselves up in the fabric of the airship, which was by then deflated, that which was lying on the ground, we thankfully slept until there was some daylight and we could see what there was to be seen. And the scene that revealed itself in the following morning was rather a deplorable sight of an airship envelope draped over some concealed oak trees.
Was the ship a write-off?
Absolutely, yes. She never flew again, I don't think. There was much damage done, and anyway, the rigid program was coming on. But as a matter of interest, we were seen by the villagers and by the troops and by the German prisoners, and they all decided that we were a Zeppelin and we should be allowed to wreck ourselves in our own way, which we did.
One thing which strikes me about that story is that apart from the inadequacy of the meteorology, which hadn't given you advance notice of this secondary depression, is the fact that you had had, before undertaking this flight to East Fortune, only one trial flight in the North Sea type airship. And I wondered to what extent the limited amount of experience you had, whether it was a contributory factor in the crash taking place.
Well, I would think that had we known each other better as a crew, and I thought that I was fairly experienced. I knew that my captain had done extremely little flying in airships because he had been commanding small stations on the ground and hadn't been up in the air at all very much, and this was all rather a new experience to him, and so that he couldn't bring the weight of experience of a captain to bear on the meteorological situation and the deteriorating weather. I, on the other hand, was a fairly subservient first officer, ready to say aye, aye, sir, to my captain and do what I was told, and wasn't at all uppish about saying, I think it's about time we decided to have a bit of a conference as to whether we should go back or not. That was never discussed. You would think that now, in hindsight, it would have been. Had we known each other better, had we not been, as it were, on our best behaviour, or at least our most service-like behaviour towards each other, we might have come to a different conclusion much earlier on, and the ship might not have been wrecked.
Now, with the crashing of the North Sea airship that you had been attached to, you found yourself still at East Fortune without an airship, and had your first experience of flying in rigids, namely in the R-24. Were there any flights in the rigid that stand out in your mind?
Well, yes, I remember several flights, but they were all of them fairly unspectacular, but amusing in their way. When the boring part of flying over a dull grey North Sea was over and you were coming back to land. And on one occasion, we were coming back, and I was with the first officer, Rafe Booth, who was later famous as the captain of the R-100. He and I were looking out of the keel window at Dunbar, and we saw a goods train starting up from the goods yard there, and he pulling out towards Edinburgh, and I knew that it would have to come on the railway close beside East Fortune Airfield, and it had about 8 miles to do, and so had we. It was about 3 miles away on our port beam, and I took an idle bet with Rafe Boo that it, the goods train, would get to East Fortune before we did, although we were going at full speed against a headwind, and he took my bet. And in the event, in fact, we very nearly hit the engine as our nose appeared over the boundary of the airfield, but the railway engine had in fact just got to East Fortune Station before this happened. So it was debatable who won the bet. The reason was that the captain of the aircraft, a splendid fellow called Sparling, who wasn't really very expert in his handling of the ship, had swiveled his forward propellers down when he should have swiveled up, maybe to make up for a certain nose heaviness at the time, and we very nearly crashed into the engine cab. Booth, in the control car, with great presence of mind, released a deluge of water ballast at that moment, which helped to regain our level and avoid us piling ourselves into the engine cab, pretty well doused both the driver and the stoker beside him in the engine cab. I remember that being very amused about that.
One of the interesting features about East Fortune, as you've already told me, is that it was the only Royal Naval Air Station which had both an airplane and an airship establishment. Could you tell me a bit about the actual scale of the setup at East Fortune?
Well, I can't remember what squadrons there were of the Royal Naval Air Service there, but they were there to serve the fleet, which was mainly based at either Scapa Flow or in the Firth of Forth. And the fast elements of the fleet, the battle cruisers, were based in the Firth of Forth. There were several squadrons attached, and they were beginning then to do the experimental landing on an aircraft carrier, instead of merely taking off. This was a base, East Fortune was a base serving the fleet, and so had both airships and aeroplanes on it, and as I said, was pretty well unique. I'm afraid I don't remember many details about we had fighters as well as reconnaissance type aircraft there, but I really can't tell you much about the types that were used.
How big was the station in terms of buildings, personnel, numbers of airships?
I suppose that there must have been 1,000 men there. The airfield occupied, I suppose it was about 75 to 85 acres. I know that I arranged for quite a lot of it to be taken over by the Agricultural Board for farming, because it was more than we required. I don't remember any particular details, except some rather amusing one, where an aeroplane pilot decided to do a spectacular stunt, and seeing both doors of one of our big airship hangars wide open, flew his aeroplane right through the hangar, which was a feat more enterprising than merely flying under a bridge, as you've often heard tell. This was a source of envy to another pilot who had, in fact, a bit of a chip on his shoulder and thought he would improve his prestige if he did the same. And he, seeing the hangar door at one end of a reserve hangar, which we'd handed over for the aeroplane people to use as a reserve storage for all their reserve aircraft, and it had about 50 aircraft in it. Well, he, seeing that the hangar door was open at one end and that mechanics were opening the door at the other end, so that both ends of the hangar were going to be open, this was rather unusual, he thought his opportunity had arisen to do this. Of course, what he didn't know was that the other end doors being opened were only being opened just wide enough to get one aeroplane out of storage, and it would then be closed up again. And while he was circling around, this happened, so that when he got himself into his dive to go slap through the hangar and was well between the windscreens and low down at a height to go through the jaws of the mouth of the hangar that was open, he saw to his horror that the far end was closed. And so this made him instantly decide that he couldn't escape in any way except by throwing himself at all the stored aeroplanes, which he did. They acted as a pleasant shock absorber for him, and when he had crushed most of them up against the far doors of the hangar and wrecked a whole lot of them, he climbed out quite uninjured, but somewhat shaken, with his prestige not greatly improved.
Now, early in 1918, you had a short spell on HMS Indomitable when you were doing your watchkeeping certificate. And the interesting aspect of that period was the work that was being done flying land planes off the turrets of the guns of HMS Indomitable. Could you describe exactly what they were doing and what the nature of flying off gun turrets involved?
We had two turrets, one on each side of the ship. On one turret there was, on the starboard forward turret, there was a fighter, which was a Camel, and on the after port turret there was a two-seater reconnaissance aircraft called a Sopwith with 1.5 strutter. We carried two pilots only, and the 1.5 strutter was meant to carry an observer, either an RNAS observer or more probably a naval observer, perhaps an assistant navigator. These two aircraft were permanently secured to the rear end of the turret, and when one was required to fly off, a platform was quickly rigged with planks on the turret, meanwhile the right out to the end of the guns, so that with the guns at a certain degree of elevation, the total slope of the platform so rigged was slightly downward. That would give a run for the aircraft of about, 75 or 80 feet at the very most on 12-inch gun turrets. That meant to say that the aircraft became airborne after a run of only that length of the platform, so that there was a further resource in the pilot's hand, which didn't amount to very much, and that was the height of the end of the platform above the level of the water. So that was not more than, I should say, 40 feet at the most. So when the ship was about to fly off one of these aircraft, the ship would be aimed head to wind, would go to full speed, the turret would be turned slightly outboard so that this effective wind speed was right down the barrels of the gun, so to speak. Then with the engine of the aircraft running full out, the pilot would be slipped and he'd charge down the runway into the wind, would come off the end of the runway, still without flying speed, would drop down and swoop down like you see a swallow or any other bird which has to take off from a height to gain final flying speed. And just before he hit the water, he'd pull up and presumably would have then flying speed and would climb away. I never saw one fly into the water, but it was a grave risk that either the pilot would not get flying speed and would stall and fall into the water, or he would dive straight into the water, but he would only miss the crest of the little waves underneath the bow or on either side of the ship. He would only miss those waves by not more than a couple of feet, if he judged the thing properly. And this was an extremely hazardous operation, and I used to watch these pilots with enchantment and with great admiration for their courage and skill.
One of the other highlights of this period on Indomitable was the record shoot which you were involved in. Could you tell me about that?
A job had to be found for me, and of course we used to do spotting practice for gunnery. There wasn't any enemy to fight. After Jutland, the German fleet had hardly put to sea at all into the North Sea. In fact, I don't think it did. But we used to continue to practice as though there was an enemy to fight. And so we made an enemy out of our own battle squadron, and similarly in other squadrons the same. The squadron would divide into two. And the enemy we had to fight were the two ships called the Australia and the New Zealand battle cruisers. In the Indomitable, I was put in the